My name is Clancy Emerson. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very glad to be back in the heart of Bristol. Glad to have had another exciting time coming here. Not on the airplane, just Sally driving me from the airport. But it's very good to be here, see some old friends, meet some new friends. Kind of cold here for people from California. But there's a young man here from Iceland. Where are you, kid? He came here to thaw out. I enjoyed your talk, Adam. And I hope you won't feel offended if I tell you something. But you're kind of new, and I'm very old. People like you really shouldn't drink. If you can't handle it like a man, forget it, you know. Every year on Friday night, they ask me to talk about something that I never know is going to be what I'm talking about. So last year I talked about a little bit of the history of AA and the traditions. And the year before that I talked on singleness of purpose. And I guess I'll have to tell my story tomorrow night, so I've got to think of something to talk about. I was thinking of something to talk about that might help somebody new here tonight. And I want to talk a little bit about a little puzzlement in AA. You know, it's a funny thing. Alcoholics Anonymous is certainly the most effective treatment for alcoholism in the history of mankind, in the 6,000 recorded years of alcohol usage or something. And in the United States, for example, where it's the most, it's a hotbed of AA if there ever is one, and there's more sobriety in the United States than anywhere else in the world on a continuing basis. And that's why it's kind of a puzzlement when you stop and think that it's estimated by one of our national societies dealing with this professionally that still in America about between 90 and 95% of alcoholics die drunk. I'm sure the percentage is as high or higher in Great Britain. I'm sure it's higher in other countries where Alcoholics Anonymous has not made an image. And you wonder why that should be, because there's an answer, and it seems to work. It seems to have an effectiveness. And it's just so many people come to AA, do not stay. So many people don't even know about AA and don't come because they have preconceived ideas. Some people come to AA and don't last very long. You know, when you look at the meetings where every week there are new people, and 52 weeks a year, 10 years, you'd think you'd have enough to fill Wembley Stadium. But the meetings grow little by little, not exponentially at all. And it's really an odd situation. And you look back and think, well, maybe we're not sincere we were as we in the old days. We're thinking about, we have a new book now. And we have the old book with the stories in it. Some of these stories have changed, sometimes with our approval and sometimes not. But you look at the old book, and it's kind of an interesting thing. It's hard to realize this. A number of people whose stories are in the old book died drunk. Many of them got drunk again. Now, why would that be? Because these were good AA members, good guys. It's just, why do these things happen? Why do people drink? And I think it gets back to something that has happened to all of us when we come here. They mentioned it as the topic of my talk tonight, a disease of perception. But certainly alcoholism is a disease of perception. And as Adam was saying tonight, we perceive life as a hopeless situation. We come to AA, hopefully over a period of time, through taking the steps at depth, hopefully, our perception changes. But then unless something continues, our perception begins to diminish again. In the program, I noticed Sally has put that thing about the invisible boat that does come to a talk I gave at the International Convention in 1985 in Montreal. And you just left one little thing out of that, you know, the point I was trying to make, which the point is that the point is the difference between good treatment centers and bad treatment centers are that bad treatment centers, when they release you, they leave you feeling that you're okay now and you don't have to do anything more. And the good treatment centers say, we're leaving you off here, but look for those two guys in the invisible boat and row like hell. And that's the purpose of a continuing effort. And I would say offhand, to the best of my knowledge, this sounds a little terrible, but I think the first three steps have kept more people out of AA than anything in history, next to booze. And not because they're bad, because they're eventually, with a change of perception, they become a trampoline that keeps you in AA. And I'm going to just talk to you a few minutes tonight about the steps. I know we all heard about the steps, or the board, or the steps, but I just want to talk about my perception. The first step that, you know, people come here and they have a terrible time, because you have to start off by admitting you're an alcoholic, and therefore your life is unmanageable, and you're a loser and a failure. It's really a terrible thing. Then you have to go to turn you have to admit you're crazy, and God's going to make it better. And if God doesn't like you, you've got no chance. Then you're going to turn your life over to God. Try that some morning when you can't pay your rent. Here, God. You sleep in the streets. That's what happens when you do that. And it really took me a long time. I think one of the great... I slipped in and out of AA for almost 10 years. I went from being a high-bottom drunk, kind of, to being a medium-bottom drunk. And the last day I drank, two big guys threw me out of a Skid Row mission in Los Angeles. I said, "Stay out of here, you damn bum." And I tried to explain to them, "I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I helped write, the L.C. Delmer ads for the Borden Company, were running that very weekend in Life and Time and the New Yorker, Saturday Evening Post. I'd had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements." How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times? But it's hard to explain these things in midair. But I knew all about AA. I knew almost as much about AA then as I do now. Isn't that odd? But I knew about, I could talk about the steps. I've been in a lot of meetings over the years, in and out, and after all, it didn't make any difference. And this time, it was raining and cold, and I walked a long way to an AA club where I was going to get out of the rain for a while. And I was in a strange city where I didn't know anybody. One guy, and I got some money, but he wouldn't give me any more. And I fell into a terrible trap of this hideous club, and there were a bunch of fanatics and all those, just crazy. And I just lurked in there because it kept raining, and I somehow stayed sober a couple of weeks. Not because I wanted to stay sober, but I had no place to go. It was still raining. And then they started the same old pattern, you know. "Get a sponsor. You've been sober 2 weeks now. Get a sponsor." And I had no front teeth. Let me tell you, if you're new tonight, about sponsors. They all pretend to be so nice. "Oh, yes, we care. We love you." But they always want to stick their nose in your business. That's what they want to do. And this guy, I used to see him come in and out of the club, and he was an actor. And he, every time I saw him in a movie, he was playing some role where he's giving people money or taking care of them or helping them. That's my new sponsor. I'll get some money from this idiot. I'll get some teeth. I'll get some clothes. My eyes are clear. I'll go back to New York, maybe get a job in an advertising agency again. I'll get some money. I'll come back out here someday, and I'll burn this club down. So I asked him to be my sponsor, and I said, "Will you be my sponsor, Bob?" Try to give him a newcomer look. He said, "Sure, I want you to do what I say." "Oh, sure, Bob." And I've often said he should have won the Academy Award for every loving role he ever played in any movie, because he was a right-wing fascist AA pig, just a terrible man. "Do this, do that." But over a period of time, he ground me down a little bit. I'll talk a little bit why maybe tomorrow night. But one of the things I did, when I was about 3 months sober, I'd had a couple of little jobs. He wasn't very sympathetic. I mean, the first week I became sober, I said, "You know, Bob, I'm an intelligent man, and I'm a sensitive man. I'm living in an abandoned car in the A-Club parking lot. I'm cold and hungry. I'm an intelligent, sensitive man, Bob. I can't live like this. What can I do?" He said, "Get a job." I said, "Get a job, for Christ's sake. Look how terrible I look." He said, "Get a terrible job." I've followed that advice to the hilt for a long time. But anyway, I had a couple jobs, and I was a smart aleck newcomer. I know nothing worse today than a smart aleck newcomer. A guy's a loser and failing and knows more than anybody. And that's no idea. Maybe I am. I've often thought, I've worked with a lot of people over the years. People send people to me. It just makes me crazy sometimes. A couple times, the doorbell rings at 2 in the morning over the past few years, and I go to the door, and there's some guy saying, "They said you'd help me." And I said, "Who?" There's a car speeding away across the park. Did you get a license number? Anything? But I don't know what I'd do if me and my early sobriety came in to talk to me. I would not put up with that kind of crap from that guy. I'm glad I found somebody better than me. And I'd had a job, but I was feeling kind of, I was making a little progress. Over 3 months, I say, I'd lost the job. I'd been living on somebody's sofa, and they moved, or I had to go leave, but I was back in that abandoned car briefly. And I got a chance, since I was out of work, to go back to the noon meetings in the club. I always like the noon meetings because all the philosophers are there. Nobody with jobs or any of that real stuff. You just go to noon and philosophize. And I had a good feeling. I was trying to be honest that day. And I said, "You know, I really envy you people because I am not really an alcoholic. I have a lot of problems. I have grave emotional problems. And my drinking pattern is pretty bad, but I am not an alcoholic, so I can't take the first step. I envy you people who can take the first step, because for years I've been going to A meetings in New York and Chicago and Los Angeles to get the heat off, and I hear people talk about the steps have done for them because they're alcoholics. But my problem is not really alcohol. And so I can't be an alcoholic, and I know these steps work for alcoholics, but they don't work for people like me. I don't know which steps, I guess some of them do, but I don't know which ones." And I try to be honest, one of the few times I was ever honest in a meeting. And about 10 seconds after the meeting, some boob called up my sponsor and said, "Here's what he said. No, Bob." So for the next 2 weeks, Bob and another guy named John Sullivan gave me a seminar on the first step, which I'll try to condense into 2 or 3 minutes. But it really was something. It went like something like this. "Wow. You're not an alcoholic. You said that and told me that before. Is that why you can't take the first step?" "That's right, Bob. I'm trying to be honest, tell you the truth. I can't admit I'm an alcoholic, really, because I'm not." He says, "Why in the first step does it say you're an alcoholic?" "Well, it doesn't actually say so, Bob. But we know what they mean. Don't kid ourselves." He says, "Why don't you ever try reading the black parts on those pages?" So what does it say? "We admitted we were powerless over alcohol." "You think you're powerless over alcohol?" "Not really." He says, "What do you think powerless means?" He says, "Well, you hear these speakers, you know, they get drunk and they rape nuns and they go to prisons and they go to Hong Kong and they're crazy. I'm just a good guy that's been screwed around a lot, Bob." He says, "I don't think that's what it means at all, kid. It means something this. It means that there's a small percentage of people in every generation who seem to get an unnatural reaction to alcohol. What do you think that unnatural reaction to alcohol is, kid?" "I said, I guess they drink, stay drunk all the time, for God, I can tell." He says, "Ah, that isn't it at all. Just the opposite. Alcohol does something special for them that it doesn't do for most people. It makes things better. After 2 or 3 or 4 drinks, it seems to change their perception of reality. Most people, after 2 or 3 or 4 drinks, get a little dizzy, want to go home. But these people now are suddenly living in a technicolor world. That's the unnatural reaction. Nothing bad will happen to you unless it's doing something for you, I'll tell you that." I said, "Yes, I guess that's happened to me, Bob. But I drank 2 or 3 or 4 drinks, and I didn't always go out and do crazy things." He says, "It doesn't mean that. You may drink 2 or 3 or 4 drinks and go home and go to bed. You may do 2 or 3 or 4 drinks and go to Mexico. You may fall in love with an 89-year-old woman on a walker. You know, something's going to happen, that's all." He says, "The trouble is, for people like this, every time they drink, it's a game of Russian roulette. And they don't even aren't aware of it. And when you're young, you sometimes get away with it. You know, oh, I thought until about 3 o'clock this morning. Boy, I got loaded. I got home in time to take a shower. Got to work. Boy, click. I met this woman at a bar last night. She turned me every way, but listen, I'll tell you, I was lucky to get out of her clutch. Click. Oh, we went to that bar last night. What a terrible bar that was. I got in a fight with the guy. I got drunk. It's just terrible. Boom. But as you get older, somebody puts more and more shells in that baby. And they wind up like you, kid. Boom. Jesus. Boom. Jesus. Boom. Jesus. There's a click in here somewhere. Boom. Jesus. See, all you got to admit that you can't tell what's going to happen, you start to drink. Is that true? That is true, Bob, but you see, that isn't the point. That isn't why my life is screwed up. I drink because my life is painful. My life doesn't get painful because I drink, although it does that too. But I have deep problems that I can't take it, and if I don't drink, I get suicidal, Bob. My life is not caused, my problem is not caused by drinking. He said, now you told me that you were an award-winning writer. I said, that's right, Bob, I was. He said, why don't you read what that says? We were admitted we were powerless over alcohol, dash. In the English language, dash means end of thought, beginning of new thought. Now we have a new thought. You have to admit your life's unmanageable. You think your life's unmanageable? Not really. He says, you're living in an abandoned car, for Christ's sake. Is that some sort of a clue or something? He said, but that isn't what it means. I'm just kidding you, kid. He said, I'll tell you what. Out in Malibu, the richest man in America, one of the three richest men in the world, perhaps, sits in AA meetings 3 and 4 nights a week, every week. And he can afford to buy chains of treatment centers. And he can buy doctors and psychologists and psychiatrists and every therapy in the world. And he sits in meetings and he says he's content. Why do you think that would be? It beats me. He said, I'll tell you something, kid. Everybody's born, every human being, rational human being is born, you eventually go along, you have problems, you have upsets, you have conflicts, a lot of conflicts, you have to work through in pain and problems, and things don't work out, and you have to go through them painfully. Now, just think, some people can take a few drinks and bury those problems, and bury those conflicts. Sometimes they come back, and sometimes they don't. Isn't it great? And it's great, you come to depend upon alcohol as a conflict resolver for an unfriendly world. But eventually alcohol gets to be a problem. So now you have to stop drinking. Then you stop drinking and you realize that these things are surfacing now. Now all the old pains are back and all the things I should have done and didn't do and all the things I did do and shouldn't have done and all the problems and come back. And eventually it gets so bad you have to have a few drinks to get some relief. But you can't keep drinking, so you got to get sober. But then you can't stay sober. You got to start drinking. But then you can't keep drinking, so you got to start sober. He says, that's the problem, kid. He says, the only thing right you I've heard you say about this, you said your problem isn't alcohol. And you're absolutely right. If your problem were alcohol, you wouldn't have to be here. He said, the problem is something called alcoholism. I said, isn't that the same thing as alcohol? He said, no, it isn't. It's a lot different. An alcohol problem is overcome by getting sober and cleaning up your act and straightening up. In this thing called alcoholism, however, you'll discover sooner or later, as you've already discovered, that getting sober and straightening up and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. He said, you know, kid, there's a name for people like you. I said, what is it? He said, you're an alcoholic. And I said, well, I'll be goddamned. Because for 10 years I'd been drinking myself and lost everything I had because I could not fit a definition of what I thought alcoholics were, what people tell me in meetings and never once think what it means. That had probably the greatest single effect on my life I've ever had. That was in the winter of 1958-59. And since that, I guess what I did, I've learned a lot more about AA since then, reading chapter 3 and so on. But I, without being aware of it, I conceded to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic that day. So what difference does that make? Here's the difference. I never could have done that. I never would have done it. Couldn't have. And since that day, I have never had a severe desire to drink. Now, I'm not saying things got really wonderful, because in those days, several times, I had desires to commit suicide, almost committed suicide once, and ran away and quit jobs and lived in. But the reason I did not drink is because I knew if I drank, if I had one beer, I just knew this as an alcoholic. Sooner or later, if I got away with it, I'd drink more. Everybody thinks if I can get away with it, you're always going to drink more. One of the sad things sometimes in AA is seeing somebody have an easy slip because they still think they can handle it. But it enabled me to never have to strong desire to drink. And that has been one of the great things in my life. I started to say, if I had one drink, sooner or later, tomorrow, next week, next month, next year, I'll find myself standing out in the street corner again one more time, and there won't be anybody in the world who cares what happens to me. That's the sad part. It isn't losing your family. You get new families, you get new homes, you get new jobs. But when you've lost the world around you, and your perception is gone, it's deadly. And I've always thought, I wish somehow I could have had that explained to me clearly when I was new in 1949. It would save me a lot of problems. But maybe it wouldn't have. I'd lit this candle tonight, I'll tell you that. I don't care. But I think that's what the first step is, and it's hard to understand because everybody thinks you've got to sit, your problem is alcohol. The problem is not alcohol. But then you get to that second step, and it's just a little bit spooky. Because now we got to return to a higher power. And I had to tell my sponsor the bad news, you know. I was raised in the Norwegian Lutheran Church, Bob. And they don't screw around there. You make two or three mistakes and you're screwed. And I was gone at 12. I remember when I got to 8, I tell him, oh, I've broken all 10 commandments. Not intentionally said that, but I broke them all. There's not much chance of me returning to God. It wasn't until a sober few years that I realized, thank God, I haven't broken all 10 commandments. I've never coveted my neighbor's manservant. Of course, in Los Angeles, we all say, who knows. But I told my sponsor, I said, I can't return to God. Talk about the second step. He says, what does it say you have to return to God? It says higher power. It doesn't say God. I said, oh, did that fool the people? Oh, that isn't God. That's a higher power. He says that it doesn't say return to anything. Nothing in AA ever says return to anything. Because we're coming out of sick perceptions and bad concepts. He says you got to try to come to believe something. That's what they ask you to do in the session. You try to come to believe that a power greater than yourself. Can't you believe in God? He said, no, I can't, Bob, because if God exists, I am damned. I cannot believe in it. He said, can't you believe in AA? I said, no, AA doesn't seem to work for me. He said, you think I'm doing better than you are? Yeah. He says, congratulations, I'm your new higher power. And I could accept that, because he couldn't send me to hell, although he came close. But people in the club, you say, there's that crazy guy thinks his sponsor is God. I knew he wasn't God. I'll tell you one thing, though, if you're kind of new and you're having trouble with God or AA, I would much rather see you believe in your sponsor that you believe in than to pretend to believe in a God you don't believe in. Because you can fool him at 8 o'clock at night, but you can't fool that dark at 2 in the morning. You better have something there that you believe in. But anyway, he said, you don't have... How could I come to believe him? And over a period of time, we worked that out. He said, you don't have to understand how it's going to happen. You don't have to see why it's going to happen. All you have to do is try to accept the concept of here, there's some power will restore you to sanity. And I always was a little nervous about that word sanity, because once upon a time I was committed to the Texas State Insane Asylum as a schizophrenic with paranoid tendencies, because I'd stayed sober so long I tried to kill myself, which is another story. But... And so I've always been a little sensitive when people call me crazy, because I'm secretly crazy. But it works out that isn't what it means at all. And over a period of time, I worked that out. I had to come to believe that a power greater than myself will restore me to sanity. Now the definition there is, what is sanity? Well, you read 10 books on mental health and you read 10 different renditions of sanity. But oddly enough, the definitions of psychosis, insanity, are pretty stable. And what psychosis is, that's mental illness not caused by brain damage, and this is highly oversimplified, of course, but when the brain, under sufficient conflict that it can't cope with, sometimes in desperation to maintain its integrity, will alter perception of an outside object to make it look different to resolve that conflict. Sometimes it's just a little thing. Sometimes it's all around. By that time, you're in a hospital somewhere. But you read about these people who seem to be living normal lives, and all of a sudden something happens that triggers that little area, and they kill their neighbors, or they do some crazy thing, or act differently. Psychosis is it's seeing reality wrong is what it is. Now, they say that alcoholism is the second greatest cause of insanity, but not that kind of insanity. Alcoholic insanity is something entirely different. Alcoholic insanity is a physical condition. Almost everyone in this room has been drunk sometimes, a few times. I know how it is sometimes you wake up in the morning, you get that fire burning, you need something to put it out, wet, cold. And the reason is because alcohol may be the only substance I know of that strips your body of moisture. It dries out your body as it dries. It dries out the cells in your body. Many of them die. And when you add fluid to your body, the cells revive. There's only two organs where cells die and don't revive. And that's your brain and your liver. And that's why you get liver problems that stick out together with malnutrition and brain problems. Now you have millions and millions of brain cells. You can kill a lot of them, go for a long time. But eventually you kill enough of them and you get a dried out brain, or at least a portion of it. It's funny, in AA we call it a wet brain, but I'm sure most of you have never seen a real wet brain, or very few of them. I see them all the time and they're terrible. They're not acting crazy in meetings and talking silly. There are people sitting on a bed, and people come and change their diapers 3 times a day, and feed them, and put them to bed, and get them up, and change their diapers, and feed them. They can never get better. They sit like that sometimes for 40 years. Their body's healthy, just their brain is gone. Their families come out once in a while to see if Dad knows them. He doesn't know who the hell they are, so they cry and go home again. That's alcoholic insanity. Neurosis is when your brain can't stand the pressure and alters your perception of reality. Now, here's the funny little thing. Alcoholics almost never become psychotic. You'd think they'd be the number one, wouldn't you? But they don't. Do you know why not? Because when it gets bad enough, long enough, they will drink alcohol and change their perception of reality. They can induce, in a sense, temporary psychosis. They can literally change the way relationship. And I'm sure every drunk in this room knows, has done it sometimes, and many, many times. Some doctors feel that sometimes alcoholics get to a point where they must drink to preserve their sanity. And so what I have to come to believe, I didn't know what sanity was. What I thought sanity was, I had a bed next to mine in a Texas nut house who guy's laughing all the time. I thought he was sane. Yeah. How are you doing today, Fred? Oh, I'm fine. And suddenly he realized he's never going to get out of there until he stops laughing. That is not sanity. That's goofiness. Somehow I have to come to believe that there's a power here. What could it be? I don't know what it could be. My sponsor? Doorknob? Something that I don't understand yet. Will enable me to live in the world without having to induce temporary psychosis to stand it. Will allow me to live in reality without ever getting so bad I have to drink to stand it. And I could accept that premise of the second step because it made sense and seemed to be logical. Came to believe that a power greater than myself would restore me to sanity. And for me, sanity is sustained reality. But then they want you to turn your life and care over to God, as you understand them. You're not getting around that one. I had to put that one aside for a while. And I went along. I stayed sober for a while. And when I was about 6 months sober, I had a little bad luck. I got fired as a dishwasher. It wasn't my fault. It seemed to me that the busboys were bringing in more dishes than the waitresses were taking out. And I thought they were getting dishes in other restaurants to humiliate me. So I didn't do a lot of them. I wasn't feeling well anyway. I got fired. And that day I decided to kill myself. If I can't hold a job in 6 months, I'm gone. I'll never see my children again. I'll never see anything in the world. What's the sense? What's the sense of living? Now I'll have to go back and live in that damn abandoned car. You said I don't have rent money. What am I going to do? So I decided to... Well, I'd just seen at the A Club on the late show television. We used to sit and watch that. A movie called A Star Is Born. At the end of that, this drunken guy walks into the ocean and everybody feels sorry later. That's for me. It doesn't hurt and I'll give it a shot. I didn't know how to get to the ocean where I was, but I had to walk back to La Siena, get over to Wilshire, walked west and walked and walked and walked and walked. And I couldn't find the ocean. I finally stopped and guessed. I said, where's the ocean, pal? He said, you're just western Beverly Hills. You have to walk past the Veterans Hospital and about another 5 miles. Not that, well, screw that. Yeah. I don't mind dying, but I'm not going to walk myself to death. But I felt so bad, I called up my sponsor, and I hated to call him because I'd have to tell him I got fired as a dishwasher, and he was always disappointed when I lost the job, very loudly disappointed. I called him, I said, Bob. He said, why aren't you working? I said, let me, Bob, let me explain something to you. You know, I've lost my family, and I've lost my career. I understand that, Bob. I don't need anything. But there's something I don't think you understand, Bob. When you're not around AA, in the club and other places, people treat me differently. They don't call on me much at meetings. They call me once and never call on me again. They old-timers warn their newcomers to stay away from me. People laugh at me and take jokes about me. You know, Bob, in my judgment, Bob, AA can't make, I doesn't work. What am I going to do? He said, why don't you write your damn inventory? And he just told me that a week before, and I explained to him, I've taken my inventory with psychiatrists, trained people. Why would I take with an out-of-work actor? What's he going to do? Say, cut, let's do that again. You know, it's nonsense. But I didn't want to hurt his feelings. I said, Bob, in my judgment, I know you mean well, but in my judgment, going over all the pain and agony I've known can't make me feel better. It's got to make me feel worse, Bob. I'm on the edge. I can't stand life. In my judgment, I need something more. And he kindly counseled me. He said, in your judgment... Who cares about your judgment? You're back living in an abandoned car, for Christ's sake. If I wanted your judgment, I'd put my head in the back window and ask you for it. He said, you're a loser. You're a loser. He really got me so cross, I came out of that phone booth just... If I'd have turned right, I'd have been in that ocean in 3 steps. I'd have been gone. But I turned left and went back to the A Club in Wilshire. I said, Sullivan... Here was a paper on the right by inventory. They gave me a pad of paper and I wrote, God, I wrote stuff I never told a soul, would never tell a psychiatrist that stuff. Somebody asked me one time, why don't you tell your psychiatrist these things? Because when you're paying that kind of money, you can't risk rejection. That's why I don't tell a psychiatrist. I don't want some little wussy to say to me, you did what, sir? Get out of my office. But first, wash off that chair. Yeah. And I put down stuff that I vomited on the page in words. And I got done and I felt better. And I just, because I proved to him it didn't work. It cheered me up a little. And I shoved on the seat of that car and I went about my business, felt a little better. And a couple days later he came by the club and said, well, get your inventory. We're going to take your inventory. I don't think I'm really ready for that step yet. I got to kind of work myself into it and get it. He said, shut up and get it in the car. So we got in the car. He drove me from Santa Monica to Oxnard, 40 miles, and gave me a flashlight. And I read this hideous thing. I thought, God, he's going to make me get out from, I'll have to walk 40 miles back from Oxnard. I finally got all done. It was worse than I remembered. And that's all, Bob. Are you done now? And you know what he said? That's the best thing you've done since you got sober, kid. And I said, thought it was. I've taken that trip over 200 times since then. Only I'm on the driver's side. There's some other puke over there with their little flashlight. It's always the same. Let me explain this part before I read it. But it's, as far as I'm concerned, inventories, good inventories, are all the same. They all have the same elements. A lot of deep-seated guilt and resentment and fear and spiritual loneliness. And it really is amazing. In 1 week, a few years ago, I heard the daughter of one of the most famous men in the 20th century read her inventory, and a week later, a guy was born under a bridge in Juarez, Mexico, never even knew who his father was, and their inventories were just about the same. I mean, their specifics were different. She lived in a penthouse, and he just out of the Washington State Penitentiary. But the same, it's just amazing. I've come to look back, and I've worked with a lot of people over the years, and I think the inventory, as we almost know, is a very, very valuable step. But I think that I have come to believe that the hardest part about an inventory is sitting down and putting the pencil on the paper and deciding what is appropriate to put down. Some people put down 150 pages of biography. Some people put down half a page. It's just... And many years ago, I did something. I'm not suggesting anyone here do it, but for the people I sponsored, to get them going on this. Now, we have a thing in the book that talks about resentments and how, which is very good. But I think that at that stage, and in the Oxford movement, where Bill was at the time, that seemed to be the answer. But the people I've known need something else. And I've had 7 questions that I've given people to write an inventory with. And the first one is, in looking back over your life, what memories are still painful, are still guilty, are still dirty? 2, in what way today do you consider yourself inadequate as a person? 3, who do you resent and why? Be as specific and nasty as necessary. 4, what do you conceive to be your defects of character as you see them today? 5, what is the nature of the ongoing problems you have with people close to you, having human relations? What seems to always happen when we have these things that blow up? 6, in what way do you see that AA can be, or how do you believe that AA can help you with any of these problems? And 7, in what way do you think AA can start to begin to change things? And I just put those 2 on the end to give a little positive spin on the end. But a lot of people pick the inventory that way. I think any way you take an inventory is fine, but I think for most people, it's a set of specific questions seem to help because they can answer it better. But it's really very simple, the 4th and 5th step. And the 5th step should, you know, in many parts of the world, and I don't know why it is, some parts of the United States, you take your inventory, you take your 4th, you take your 5th step, you go find a clergyman and take it with a minister or a priest. There are some priests who specialize in it. Some clergymen, but Minneapolis is a guy that just specializes in listening to 4 steps. And in our part of the country, which is Los Angeles, that's entirely different. There you always take your inventory with your sponsor. Because you're asking him to guide your life, and then you want him to know about you. Isn't that just silly? You say, well, what if he's a blabbermouth and tells these things? It isn't that interesting. You know, I mentioned this last year, but in passing, you know, I'll tell you a guy that should be worried. I watched my daughter go down the aisle and marry a guy I sponsored. Well, I wasn't in favor of, but they didn't ask me. But if you want to know the absolute definition of mixed emotions, it's watching your darling daughter marry someone whose 5th step you've heard. You can't really say anything, but you can give little warnings. Let me know if he ever brings a sheep home, honey. But that is a great... You know, you stop and think about it. Psychoanalysis, psychiatric help, usually would take you up to step 5 if they're doing steps. Then after that, it's a kind of a lot of conversation. But the great thing about AA is that's when AA begins to kick in. Now you've stayed sober a while. to me, taking the first three steps or staying sober, well, the reason I mention that inventory is because I look back, the day I took that inventory is the day I took the third step. Because I believe the third step means what it says. You're not making it. You have problem drinking, problem sober. There's a power here that will help change it. Now you got to do what they say. It's just that simple. You got to follow what they say. You got to surrender your judgment. That's the hardest surrender in the world, I know, for people like me. I'll surrender my money or my clothes, but not my judgment, because I know more about me than anybody else does. And I have to come to believe that isn't necessarily true. So you take a fourth and fifth step, and I think that's where you really turn your will and your life over to the care of God, if you continue to do it. And then there's the sixth step. I get sometimes questioned, how do you really do the sixth step? I've been working on it for weeks, and I don't understand that. The sixth step is really quite simple. Became willing. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. All that means is I don't know anybody who doesn't want to stop hurting. That's all you're saying. To have God remove, become willing to have God remove these defects of character. And so what are the defects of character? The defects of character are the things you found out in your fourth and fifth step. And I know that I tell people, as I did, my sponsor told me, you go home and kneel down tonight. And you pray to God to help you become willing to get rid of the things that are in a pattern eating you up. Because that's what you find out, I think, in the fourth, fifth step. Your life's a series of patterns, doing the same things, screwing up, not allowing yourself to succeed, eventually screwing up, always having problems with human beings. To become willing to have God remove these defects of characters is an easy step. And the seventh step follows it. There's a seventh step prayer in the book to help you along, but really all it means is simple, very simple. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. You know, that's the funny thing about people who like to make AA complex. You go to meetings sometimes, I've heard when I was new, debates in meetings, what the difference between shortcomings and defects of character. And of course, Bill wrote later that he just didn't want to be redundant in two consecutive sentences. They mean exactly the same. But when I ask God to remove these defects of character, I don't know how he's going to do it. I don't see how he can do it. And you're not going to sit on your knees and wait for a lightning bolt to come down the window and straighten you out, because you're not. But you have to become willing to do that. Then the eighth step, made a list of all persons who had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And again, as Adam said, past and passing, it's a matter of putting down a list of people you have harmed, even though they have harmed you worse than you have harmed them. That's not the point. You put down a list of persons you had harmed and how they harmed you. And I've gone over that with a lot of people. Then you make amends. And that's a tough step, because sometimes the amends you need to make the most are the ones that are the most difficult. I was thinking about that when Adam was talking tonight. I hated my father because he left my mother and I felt in the late 1930s and married somebody else eventually, and my mother and I, she married someone I didn't like, and I didn't like my wife's, my mother-in-law, my stepmother. And I grew up, and I had great love for my father when I was a kid, and he turned on me. And I hadn't talked to him for 10 years when I took that inventory. And he said the same thing to me. Our sponsors were at the same school. He said, your number one demand is to make your father. I said, I'm not going to make amends to him. He screwed up my life. That may be, kid, but you were a bad son. That's all I care about. I want you to write him a letter of amends. Uh-huh. And then he said something that I've said to everybody since then, too, and you better say it. I want to see it before you send it. So I wrote a letter of amends. He said, no, not an indictment. A letter of amends. I had to write that three or four times. The old fool finally accepted it. And I felt ashamed to even send it to him. So that he and my stepmother would laugh. But then I got a letter back from my dad, and I said, I'm glad to hear you're doing all right, son. I haven't heard you for so long. I hope you're all right. I bet you are. You and your new wife and your new child and all that crap. Screw you. And he said, now, it's his birthday coming up. He asked me his birthday. It was March 20th. It said his birthday. And Christmas and cards. And I just did this, and my dad would send me little letters and tell me what's going on. I didn't, half the time I didn't even read them. Just feel, I don't care what's going on. I'm doing this only among other amends I was making. When I was about 5 years sober, I'd been working hard. I finally had some front teeth. I was advertising director for a medical corporation. I smiled a lot. In case any of your buddies new here and have lost teeth, let me give you some hope. Once you become spiritually pure, they grow back. You don't know. What do you know, dummy? My mother and father both lived in a town called Eau Claire, Wisconsin. My mother lived in one part of town. My dad lived in another part of town. And I was going up to Minneapolis to give a talk at this medical convention. And he said, I'm going to see my mother. And he said, I guess that was 4 years old. He said, I want you to still go over and see your father, too. I don't want to go see my father. My stepmother will be there, and I'll punch her in the nose. He said, no, you make arrangements to see her. So I went up there. I remember that date, winter time, when I left my mother's house. I just hated to go over there. Just that tall, overpowering guy and his damn vicious wife. I rang the doorbell, and the door answered. Here's this short, little, gray-haired guy. He shrunk somehow. And I said, Dad, I've just come to say hello. He said, come on. I said, no, I don't want to come. He said, no, I understand. I know your feelings. Val, my wife, I sent her downtown to do some shopping. Come on, at least have a cup of coffee. I said, okay. I came and sat down and looked around all the nice things my mother didn't have. It was very nice, Dad. I didn't say anything, but I thought it was just another indictment. Hope you're doing well, Dad. Nice to see you. I left. About 6 months later, I was coming across, doing something up in the Midwest. I went to see my mother again. I went and saw him again. I did the same thing. And that's the end of it. I've made all the amends I can make now to hell with him. When I was 5 years sober, my wife and my children in Dallas heard the crinkle of green in my wallet, leaped out of their post office box, rushed to my side. So all of a sudden, I'd gone from being a 5 years sober new guy to doing well. A swinging bachelor in L.A. Now my family was back, which was great, because I love my children. But it did cut into my accident a little bit, because I've been, you know, for several years I've been able to say, you know, I've lost my family, and I'm alone now, over at 922 Gardner Street. And people would say, oh, it must be sad for you without your family. Yes, it is, but I'm soldiering on. Now they're back, and all of a sudden, God, 4 kids, 3 dogs, 2 cats, a wife. I didn't get to the bathroom for 3 days at one time, I don't think. Just noise and cats going and dogs and children. And I'd go to aid desperately trying to find help, and they'd say, well, you're happy at last, aren't you? About a month or 2 months after that, I got a call from my father. He says, son, Val, his young wife, died suddenly last night of a heart attack. And I would really appreciate if you come up here and spend a few days with me and go through this funeral. And I've often thought, you know, very likely I might have said, gee, Dad, I'm sorry you're lonely. That's the way Mother and I were, too, for a lot of years. Goodbye. But right then, as he was talking, a dog chased a cat through my legs, and the cat went up the curtain, and my kids were yammering and yelling, and I just, I'll be right up, Dad. I went to Eau Claire, Wisconsin. I went through the, I wasn't warm or anything, but then after the funeral, before I was going to catch the plane the next morning, I sat, and I thought, I'm just going to once and for all get this to me. I said, Dad, why did you desert Mother and I? He said, desert Mother and you? What a strange question. Don't you think I loved you? I said, I don't know, Dad. He said, don't you remember in the 1930s, I was a school teacher making $80 a month, and I worked every night so you could have a bicycle, worked in different jobs. I tried to give you everything I could. We didn't have much, but I gave you and your mother. And your mother and I grew apart. We decided to separate. It was kind of painful for me, but we decided to separate. I thought you knew that. And then I met this woman, and she seemed to be kindly, and we married. And I always tried to be loving towards you. And then you went off early in the war, ran away from home, and got in the service, went off to the South Pacific and came back. By that time, you were drinking a lot of bit, not a lot, but more than you should have, I think. And you went to college. I'm so proud of what you did in college. And you won some awards for the college. You won a national championship and got married to this lovely girl. And you went out in the world. And I tried to help you and help. And you always treated me coldly. You didn't want me to see your children. It broke my heart a lot of times. I said, "Could I come over?" And, "No, we're busy now, Dick." I just didn't like it. And he gave me an entirely different perception of the same series of facts. I couldn't believe it. It's like that movie Rashomon, where they have six different people seeing a robbery, and they all look different. And I left there that day, and I no longer hated my father, I'll tell you that. And I began to understand him. And after the next few years, I think I got closer than most fathers and sons ever get, because I really tried to be good. And but he got old, and he came out and lived with us in California for a while. Then he wanted, like an old elephant, to go back to burial ground. He wanted to go back to Wisconsin and die with the Norwegians. And he went back there, and as he was dying, I was holding his hand, and he smiled, and I smiled. I visit his grave every so often now. But the point I'm trying to make is this. If I had followed what I knew to be right, tonight if you'd come up to me and ask me about my father, I'd say, "My father, to hell with my father. He abused our family. He's dead now. I hope he's in hell. I hope they're poking him with sharp knives. I just wish that son of a bitch was in a lot of pain." But as a result of doing things I didn't want to do and making amends and that crap, if you'd ask me about my father, I'd say, "My father and I really, unfortunately, were pulled apart for a lot of years, but thank God we got close, and he's dead now. I hope he's in Valhalla, the Norwegian heaven. I hope he's having a good time. I hope he's saving a seat right next to him. When I get there, we'll drink some non-alcoholic something. Mead." But nothing had changed in the history of the world, except my perception changed, which is the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, to change your perception of things. And it's so hard to realize that, because the perception you're coming out of indicates that's the wrong action. That's why it's so essential, I think, that you have to have some place to turn it over to. And people always say, "Well, the first nine steps are pretty much clearing up, and then you get into..." Most of you know, some of you new people may not. In the ninth step is where the 12 promises appear. It says, if you are thorough about this stage of your development, if you are thorough about your amends, the promises start to happen. That's one of the great reasons I always thought that book was inspired, because Bill Wilson wrote a series of promises that hadn't happened to him yet. Like one of these dime store get well where they write all kinds of promises they never work out. But these do come true. And old timers will tell you that. But since we're human beings, they don't stay true because we screw them up. Remember when my family first came out, I called up my sponsor. "Hey, Bob, they've got more... They need a lot of things financially. I don't know if I can handle it." They said, "Financial insecurity will leave me. I'm financially insecure, Bob." I said, "No, that is what it says at all. It says fear of financial insecurity will leave you. Shape up." Well, he died soon thereafter. I got another sponsor who was more loving. But the tenth step is, I think it means what it says. I think the tenth step means what it says. It means we continue to dig daily inventory. That doesn't mean that I sit and write. I don't understand. I'm not against it. But I do not understand people who write, continue to write. Because that's such a self-obsessive thing for people like me. I'm back in myself. The whole purpose of AA is to get out of self and to continue to write. "Oh, how am I feeling today? I better find out." We do a lot of that in LA, I guess. But the purpose is to examine my life. One of our philosophers say the unexamined life is not worth living. But not to be focused on me, because I've got to get off of me. I never need any help in looking at me. I need some help to get off me. And when I'm wrong, promptly admit it. And when you're new, that's difficult. But when you're an old timer, that's difficult. You'd think that you'd just automatically do it, and sometimes you do, but sometimes you don't. Because it's a very difficult proposition. I mean, because at the moment I say or do something, usually I think I'm right. When I think about it, I'm not. But And I got an image to maintain a person who's not, who's childish. What I'm doing is not childish. I can't, you know, it really is. It's a simple thing. To examine, continue to examine myself and do it, my wrong, promptly admit it. Once you say, I'm sorry, there's not much more going to be said. You can talk all afternoon and make excuses. When you say, I'm sorry, it's over. Sometimes you have to say you're sorry, but you have to draw a fine line. At least I do. I'm not sorry for the position I took. I'm just sorry the way I said it. I'm not sorry for saying AA really does work, but I'm sorry for saying, what the hell's wrong with you? So I have to say, I'm sorry I flew off the handle when I talked to you. I mean, it's all sorts of little dumb little things you have to do to get right with yourself. The 11th step has always seemed very interesting to me. It says, sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand it. And somewhere along the line, I had to remember, somewhere in my first or second year, I suddenly, after listening to people, I came to believe in AA, to work for people. And eventually, I came to believe in God. And later on, I was trying to explain to people, I had such an antipathy towards that whole concept. How could I believe in God? And the belief I came to believe in was a very rudimentary one. But because of my own phoniness, I had to, in a kind of phoniness, I had to believe in something that made sense. I just couldn't believe in some, you know, they talk about God's grace keeps us sober. Well, how about all the people that aren't sober? Where's God's grace for them? Is God, does he go through AA meetings and say, you can stay sober, you two will slip, you can't stay, you know. If that's true, I can't stay here, because I'm not going to make the cut, you know. And I heard these old guys like Chuck Chamberlain, who became my second sponsor, and other great AA speakers, talk about the love of God, that God loves you. I thought, well, he doesn't love me. But I finally came to understand, they're trying to say that God loves everybody, and he loves them all the same. Not one more than the other. He loves them all the same, but some of them don't do very well. And the concept I could pick up from that, because at that time I was working in television, I was still in that medical corporation, but God, I had an image of God, God's grace, whatever it is, as a kind of a television, big television station. And he's sending out a picture of peace of mind or grace or whatever you want to call it. And he's sending it to everybody the same, just like when they have the World Cup all over the world, people look at the television set. World Cup doesn't know who's got the sets on, but they're sending a picture out there. And some of the sets are old, and some of them don't work very well, and some of them don't even get turned on, because I know pictures can't fly through the air. But the picture's out there. And now in my home, I used to be a sports writer, and I'm still a great fan of sports, and I'm a great football fan. In the fall, we have a lot of football games. I have two sets, one next to each other in my den, so I can, you know, really great. I've had a lot of grandchildren. They're a mixed blessing at best. I now have a great-grandson that makes me feel so old I can barely walk. But used to be, I'd be watching a game, and I'd go to the John or something, and these kids, John and Joe, used to think it was fun to change all the dials on it, these old TV sets, and I'd come back, there'd be blue people, and it didn't take me long to understand that if I turn the knobs right, the picture gets clear again. And I don't know what a vertical hole does. I have no idea what those electrons are doing in there. Doing something terrible, I suppose. I don't care what they're doing. I just turn that vertical hole and the picture stops. And the horizontal hole gets them straight. And the tint gets them from blue to white again, or yellow, or whatever it might be. And I don't really care. Get out of here, you kids. I had to come to believe, in a sense, that's what God's grace was coming down as. Now, I don't have a TV set with knobs that say vertical hold and horizontal hold, and so I had to find something else. I had to come to believe that there's not a vertical hold, but there's a prayer. There's a prayer knob. I don't know that my prayers ever got answered. I've never known that any prayer I ever said got out of the room I was in. I've never had any evidence. But when I turn that knob, the picture gets a little clearer. When I try to be of help to somebody, even if I thought it's dumb, that picture gets a lot clearer. When I sit in meetings, the picture gets a little clearer. When I try to alter my behavior, the picture gets a little clearer. And sometimes I get very clear pictures. It just sends a shiver down my spine. And if you don't like God's grace, you can call it peace of mind or serenity, whatever you want. Unfortunately, as a human being, my pickup truck, my TV set seems to be in the back of a pickup truck. Every time I just get a picture, it goes, and my life is just a series of, oh, Jesus. I said, no. Won't the picture ever stay here? Yes, I'll come over. But I could accept that concept, and I could pray earnestly to that God. And over the years, I've become a little more deeper personal God, I suppose, like the 11th step, sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God. And I come to believe I pray to God earnestly every day now, have for 40-some years. But I know this, that I have to seek to improve that concept, if I will. But the most telling part of that step to me, and it has been one of the few steps I've ever tried to do perfectly, praying only for knowledge of His will for me and the strength to carry it out. Because I have, you know, that dickering with God, if you'll do this, get me out of this, I'll do this. And I am such a, innately, I'm a hustler or a bad guy or something, I suppose. And from the first time I prayed honestly, I've never tried to pray for anything. I haven't tried to pray for a job, a car, a woman, a nothing. I pray for knowledge of God's will for me and the strength to carry it out. And I guess I must have got some of that strength because my life has improved. But I got to be very careful. That is such a... I hear people say, "Boy, I'm going to really pray I get that job." I think, if God, you know, it may not be what's right for you, pal. Maybe you'll get it. Maybe you'll be sorry. So I have come to believe that praying for knowledge of God's will for me is enough for hustlers like me. If I do anything more than that, I'm crossing the line. So now you get to that last step, and having had a spiritual experience, that's the interesting thing. Most of us know Bill Wilson had this spiritual experience. And 3 years later, he wrote the big book, and he presented it, and it got printed. And there's only one word been changed in the 12 steps from the first printing to now. And in 1939, that big red book, it said, having had a spiritual experience as the result of these steps. And the people came to him and said, "Gee, Bill, that's not right. You're the only one who had a spiritual experience. And you never was a result of these steps. You had it before you were drunk in Towns Hospital. How do you figure that out?" Dr. Jung said, "We have to have a spiritual experience. I never had any spiritual experience. You're the only one. Does that mean we're all going to get drunk? What the hell does this mean?" And they pondered that for a while, because fortunately the book didn't sell very fast, so they had a lot of time to ponder it. And I think that they finally came upon, I believe, from the people I know that were around at that time and shortly thereafter, they finally came to the conclusion by looking around people, maybe Dr. Jung was right. Maybe you need a spiritual experience, but not... You couldn't get one the way Bill got one because they were so rare. Dr. Jung had never seen one. He only read about it. The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is that in some way that nobody can explain really, it's still a mystery, that the 12 steps, Adam, bring about an incremental spiritual experience. Not the way Bill Wilson got his, boom, but the way we get ours. Make amends to that bitch. Are you crazy? And little by little, slowly alter the perception of reality. And so the next printing of the book, they change it to having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And it's been that way ever since. That's what really makes it such a remarkable thing. Now, they want to go back in that book all the time and say, "Well, he stole this part from here, and some of that's from the Oxford movement." Who cares? The way it's laid out now is the first thing that's ever worked for alcoholics in the history of mankind. Who cares? It works fine for me. But having had a spiritual experience, it's really these steps, we try to practice these principles in all our affairs, and people think, what does that mean? I mean, you have to be honest and pure. You have to be absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness. You know, old four concepts. And I don't think it means that. I think that one of the reasons that I think Bill Wilson avoided those type of things in the 12 steps, and in our book, is because he realized people like us are kind of perfectionist. I want things to be right. And if they're not, screw them. I don't want... You know, Yale University had a big study of alcoholics in the 1950s. They really did a massive study. The only one... They had alcoholics of all sorts and backgrounds and histories. And then they compared them against non-alcoholics. They even got down to things like giving the known alcoholics two drinks and the known non-alcoholics two drinks and try to measure their reactions. Wouldn't be fun to be part of that test, you know. That's all for today. No, it isn't, goddamn it. But of all the people they examined, they had a big report this off. But it has been said that the only two, couldn't find any background. They had two things they found, neither one which they could understand. One, the alcoholics all marked in the top 10 percentile in sociological or psychological profiling of perfectionism. And secondly, the alcoholics seem to have a